League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Manziel feeling the pressure, extending the play, turning the shoulders, back across the green and intercepted by Jacquawski Tart, the rookie out of Sanford, on an ill-advised heave from Manziel.
Drouin, shoot, score! He set it up for Palat.
Drouin has made two wonderful plays there in the power play.
Richard Turner shoots it. It's into the crowd. Another shot coming from Richards. And another maybe. And the blue light is on. This game is done. Tampa Bay wins it.
Well, we obviously lost the game on specialty teams, both the power play and penalty kill. Regarding the power play, I thought we had too many unforced errors. I didn't think we won enough pucks when they did pressure us. They did a good job not letting us set up, and so you got to win those pucks. Once we got set up, we didn't do, in my opinion, probably a good enough job of finding a way to get pucks to the net.
I think the series is always about adjustments from game to game, and I sense they will have some adjustments coming into tonight. So we have to be ready for whatever. We have a defensive plan, we have an offensive plan, and we have to execute that to best of our abilities. And
you have to win one. It doesn't have to be one of the first two. I mean, you know, you got to win. And I just know the math. I mean, you got to win 1, 2, 5, or 7. So. You got to win one or you can't win the series. So.
We got to move the ball a little more when they double team. Things like that, getting back in transition, getting matched up, not having like little mental breakdowns because, you know, every possession counts. So, try to defend as hard as we can and, you know, continue to play. I thought we played really well.
You know, from game to game, I mean, there's going to be adjustments that have to be made. And, you know, when you watch film and you watch the team and you watch, you know, what they do best and what they try to do, you have to adjust to it. And you have to adjust for the team, for our team, and to help us be better. So there's going to be a lot of adjustments throughout the series, I believe. In.
Should have asked me. Okay. I got screwed. Okay. Now, and I want to make this clear. When Sports Illustrated came out with their 50 most fashionable people in sport, the fact that I wasn't on that list is a travesty. I mean, I'm known for my fashion, am I not?
From Toronto.
No, I mean, come on. I mean, you know.
If you mix in a tie or a bow tie, you're there. You're 50.
No, but I mean, I'm known for my fashion. I mean, I was very disappointed. That's the question you should ask.
All right.
This is the Bob Brandt's Athlete Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on, are we, in hour number two of the Extravaganza Radio on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Big news out of Cleveland today. The trading, of course, of the number two overall pick to the Eagles. But the other big news is also in Cleveland tonight, and that is, of course, game number two between the Pistons and the Cavaliers. Welcome back to the Extravaganza. Excuse me. I hate when I get coughing spells, and I've been fighting a springtime cold. Well, it's kind of a late winter, I guess, early springtime cold for like a month and a half now, and it still comes back to bite me. Anyway, we do continue. Want to make that sharp left turn out of the NFL and into the NBA and talk about game number two. Stan Van Gundy, of course, still reeling. Really not reeling because he's kind of having some fun with it from the fine for saying that LeBron James gets to do whatever he wants. Joining us now to talk about the series is David Mayo, MLive.com, covering the Pistons for MLive. David, how are you this afternoon?
Hey, good afternoon.
Appreciate you joining us. David, we talked a lot about yesterday. Excuse me.
Well, isn't that nice?
No, it is. We were talking there. We were talking to Aaron McMahon about one of your colleagues, obviously, about the series and how Stan Van Gundy, in your view, and I think the headline was five things that Stan Van has to do for game number two after being outcoached in game number one. And I'll tell you what, nobody really would have thought that Ty Lue, in his first ever playoff game as a head coach, would outcoach one of the great coaches, I think, working today in Stan Van Gundy. But I think you were right, spot on. He really did, you know, especially when he went small and Stan Van really didn't respond to that very well.
You know, and there were probably people in Detroit who took that as some sort of affront to Van Gundy. There are only two coaches in the game. unless it's every round is 10-10 to draw a boxing parallel, one of the coaches is going to pull a string or two that's a little better than the other. Do I think Van Gundy cost them the game? Absolutely not. I think what cost them the game was the big three going for 81 points, which is extremely uncommon, and the fact that they had some second-chance opportunities and some points off turnovers that they just couldn't account for. LeBron plays with great force. You can complain about fouls. I don't think officiating decided the game. I think Ty Lue did do some really smart things with personnel, going small and going with Love even before the fourth quarter. Back in the third quarter, going with Love more in the post than he has most of the year, kind of changed the tone of the game a little bit. And then, yeah, in the fourth quarter, I thought the small ball lineup really changed things. But what I wrote was that there are five things he should at least consider. I don't think he'll do all of them. He may not do any of them, but I think there are probably one or two that he will.
Yeah, and I think there everything you wrote. I hope nobody in Detroit, no Pistons fans, really took an affront to that. I think you're very spot on. You know, somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. Sometimes that has something to do with a move that the guy on the bench makes, and sometimes not. It's just a matter of players. It's fair. But one of the things that even Stan kind of said afterwards, he regretted a little bit not using Stanley Johnson more because he was effective. The 19-year-old was very effective. Well, he was effective. I don't know if I'll go very, but he was effective as anybody else could be, really, on LeBron James in that game. And what I liked about it is we moved to game number two tonight. You know, if I'm a Pistons fan and I'm listening to Stanley Johnson, I'm thinking, give that guy some minutes. Give him more opportunities. He does not seem in awe of the moment. He is not intimidated by the four-time MVP. He said, you know, if LeBron James wants to play physical, and I'm paraphrasing him here, but if he wants to play physical and try to throw me to the ground, then you know what? Let's go. I'm going to throw him to the ground, too, and just hope I don't get too many fouls called against me. And I like that attitude.
Well, I do, too. I mean, and I think if, you know, these are obviously two teams at two completely different stages of life. The Cavs are built to win now, and the Pistons, as you just outlined, are perhaps going to use a 19-year-old to try and counteract him a little bit more tonight. That's a pretty big challenge. That's a pretty big sentence. He's 19 years old. He's a tough kid. He's an L.A. kid, a city kid, who's extremely intelligent and understands the stakes here. He understands that his franchise is looking to move forward over the next two or three years, and that he's a big part of it, and that this is a big part of development. And, you know, there were some things that went on with Stanley late in the season. He got DNP'd a couple of games right before the last game of the season here in Cleveland, and he and Van Gundy weren't exactly seeing eye to eye on things at that moment, but there was kind of almost a denial to acceptance three-phase thing with him, from I don't can't believe the guy DNP'd me to ultimately Stan knows what's best to me and for me all in a matter of a few days. So he's an emotional kid, but he's contained those pretty well most of the year, and he's got a big challenge ahead of him tonight. I think that's one of the things that you definitely will see is Stanley Johnson trying to bang with James a little bit more.
Yeah, and if anybody is built to do it, 6'7 and 240, I mean, it's not quite as big as LeBron or physically, you know, as mature perhaps as LeBron James is, just given their ages. But, you know, LeBron's, what, 6'8, 250? Stanley can bang with him a little bit. And most importantly, again, he's not intimidated by him. Now, the question is, David, is where's the line between confidence, and I'm not going to be in awe here just because he's a four-time MVP and a two-time champion, and being foolhardy. When you make a statement like the one that he made yesterday, we talked about this some too, again, with Aaron and with a couple of other Pistons writers. He said, with the film study I'm going to do on him, speaking of LeBron James, Stanley said, with the film study I'm going to do on him, I think I can take some things away from him. That's pretty heady stuff. I don't care if you're a 19-year-old or a 29-year-old telling the MVP, yeah, I can take some things away from you. I'm studying film. I'm gonna know the book on you. So is he over that line a little bit there between confidence and poking the bear, so to speak?
If he is, he won't be on the floor that much. See, that's the thing. I mean, we're only talking about a kid who, what, he played 16 minutes or something last game. And when I say you'll see him on the floor more, it's not like you're going to see 26 minutes of Stanley Johnson tonight. Right. That's not the way the Pistons rotate. They're not going to do anything that much drastically different unless they actually do try to go small. And then Stanley Johnson, you will see 26 minutes of Stanley Johnson if they actually do, which I think would be an audacious move. They haven't done it all year. Then you could see where Stanley Johnson may have to back those words up a little with substantially more minutes than he had in game one. You know, he was on the floor for 16 minutes. He had just a few minutes matched up with LeBron. They won't expose him that much more, you know, but I think you will see him try and bang with him more, and he may have to back those words up. And if the Pistons get down 10 or 12 or 14 tonight, which they didn't in game one, then things are going to get a little tough.
We're talking to David Mayo, who writes about the Pistons and more on MLive.com or for MLive.com. And game number two tonight, of course, is still in Cleveland. And, you know, the big three played about as well as they can play together. We talked about this, and I'm sure you did too, and wrote about it. It's, you know, what I'm trying to go back through the numbers, 28 and 13 for Love, 22 and 11 assists for LeBron, and obviously Kyrie with 31 and 6 assists and was very hot outside. They don't normally have that kind of chemistry where they're all going off at the same time. It's been one of the one of the problems, I guess, if you will, that they've had in becoming a consistently great team, and they've kind of maybe publicly undercut one another on that in that regard a few different times. But David, they played about as well as I think they can play together, and it was still a very competitive game. The Pistons were in up into the end, and they were in fact up 7 in the fourth quarter. So I guess my overall question here in the lead up to that is the gap between these two teams as big as 1 versus 8 says it is?
No. And I told a guy, one of my fellow beat writers the other day, that I think this could be a four-game series that in hindsight will be viewed as a competitive four-game series. I think there is such a thing, regardless how many games this series goes. I think, I'll tell you this right now, I think if the Pistons get run out of the gym in any game before a closer, it'll be tonight. That said, what'd they take? 73, 74 field goal attempts in game one. They played a Cavs pace, and the Cavs were getting all the second chance shots, and the Cavs were getting all the turnovers going their way. Detroit won't shoot as well in game two as it did in game one. The big three won't score 81 points in game two like they did in game one. If one of those teams does, that team wins the game tonight. It's that simple. But you don't expect that kind of game again. I wouldn't be surprised to see, at least tonight, this game get ground down to absolute possession-by-possession powder with very few transition opportunities either way, first team to 90 wins. Wouldn't surprise me in the least to see both these teams engage just a grind-it-out defensive struggle, bashing each other, depending on how it's called. And if that happens, it does neutralize the better team, which clearly is Cleveland. Everyone knows that. But I think, you know, Detroit has played fearlessly all year. Detroit was third in the league, not first game notwithstanding, in fourth quarter point differential. They don't shy away even when they're behind and in seemingly hopeless situations. Go back and look at the Portland game in the fifth game of the year or whatever it was, and how they came back in that game, 41-11 in the fourth quarter when they were hopelessly behind. All year long, they've continued to scrap whether they're up 5 or down 17. So they won't go away. They are a pesky team. They won't roll over until you get them in a clincher situation, and then you never know what's going to happen. But I don't think the differential – they are a team on the rise. Cleveland is a team that's already there. But I thought all along that this could be a competitive series. Cleveland will win it. Cleveland will win it, but I think Detroit can acquit itself well.
I think you're right. And by the way, you said earlier on, I think, that you expect it to be a four-game sweep, but it's a competitive four-game sweep. I'm actually thinking that Detroit can win it.
I actually picked the series in six. before it started. I thought they could steal a game in Cleveland. That might have been a little optimistic. Maybe it's five, but I agree with you. I don't really think it goes four games. Just if it goes four games, it could be a competitive four-game series.
Yeah, and I'm picking five. I think the Pistons will get one in the Palace, probably game three. That's my guess. But a lot of that's going to depend on Reggie Jackson, which you wrote about today. And I'd like you to expand upon a little bit. Reggie Jackson is the unquestioned leader on the floor of this team. He lost his cool a little bit at the end of game one and drew, you know, the wrath of Stan, and rightfully so. It was a tee he could not get. But, B, you talk about this in your piece today. That Mr. Clutch persona that he kind of carved out for himself earlier on, it doesn't have to apply here. And maybe that's what was going on a little bit as he dribbled the air out of the ball in clutch situations toward the end of those last couple possessions in game one, trying to do something special and spectacular. As you wrote, he needs to be clutch, but he doesn't have to be Mr. Clutch. What is that? What's the difference?
Well, he take the shots that are available. When you're getting blitzed on the pick and roll, give the ball up just like he did for the first 42 minutes when he was a great teammate and everything that they had all year until the last 6 minutes. He gets the bad technical foul. He grinds him into a shot clock violation. He takes a couple bad shots. He's dribbling the ball against a double team rather than getting off of it. Make the right play. It really just comes down to make the right play. You're in a pick and roll heavy offense. He's the heaviest pick and roll ball handler percentage guy in the NBA at a right around, I don't know the exact number, but about 60% of the plays that he's on the floor, he's the ball handler in a pick and roll offensive play. So if you're in that position, you know what's coming. They're going to blitz you. They have to stop your pick and roll. And you have to make the right decision almost every single time out of it. And for 42 minutes, he did, and for 6 minutes, he didn't. That's unlike him over the course of the year. But, you know, there's seven games in a series. He needs to get that straightened out tonight.
No question about it. And David Mayo is our guest from MLive.com covering the Pistons and watching the Pistons try to even the series against the Cavaliers tonight in game number two. In game one, in addition to Kyrie Irving going off for 31 and 6 against Reggie Jackson and the Pistons defense, he played better defense. This is something that in the regular season, when they matched up, Reggie Jackson had some games against Kyrie Irving and against the Cavaliers and put a lot of pressure. And a lot of people said, man, boy, Kyrie has taken giant steps backwards in terms of his defense from a year ago. Maybe that's different under Tyronn Lue this year. I don't know. But I kind of thought that I would see more of Reggie Jackson really pressing the issue with Kyrie Irving. Do you think that Kyrie has taken that personal challenge on and that he's making things a little tougher on Reggie? Or is Reggie just not perhaps asserting himself the way he needs to, the way he did in the regular season?
I think Reggie's turning the corner and seeing a lot of Tristan Thompson.
So Kyrie's getting help then?
Yeah, Kyrie's getting help, of course. And they know that Reggie, look, for a split second there, when you jump him with Kyrie and Tristan, he's going to have one guy open. They're going to be playing 4-on-3 for a minute if he finds it. It's most likely going to be Andre Drummond, and he's a little reluctant with his trust to put the ball in Drummond's hands in the open court and trust him to make the right play. So that's kind of what it comes down to, is limitations at other positions, Reggie trying to make the right decision and yet not expose teammates in bad spots. So, you know, it's a touchy spot. They figured out they have to corral the pick and roll. It's the number one item on every defensive game plan against the Pistons. Rein in Reggie Jackson on the pick and roll. Cleveland did a really good job on it in game one. Most of the time, Reggie made the right play out of it, but they really tripped him up with the small lineup in the fourth quarter. And so, you know, things went the way they went. He just really needs to make the right decision. You cannot single team. You can't not jump him on the pick and roll, or he will drive the ball incessantly. He will drive, and he will drive, and he'll press the issue, and he'll do exactly what you're describing. But they took that option away from him in game one. They will continue to do it. They will continue to try and take away Reggie Jackson's drive for as long as this series goes by making him see a big man every time he turns a corner on pick and roll.
David, we've touched on two of the big three that the Pistons have to contend with. Maybe Stanley Johnson get a few more minutes against LeBron. Now, of course, Kyrie. What about Love? You wrote about him yesterday, too, that you can expect or that Kevin Love better expect to get roughed up a little bit more by the Pistons. What are we talking about here? Are we talking Mahorn, Lane Beer, bad boy style roughing up? Or what are we doing with the finesse player that Kevin Love is?
Yeah, I don't think you're. I don't think you're going to see Karl Malone on Isaiah Thomas. Let's say that. You know, you're not going to see. You know, if it was 1989, you'd see somebody on his head and shoulders. But it's not. It's 2016. So no, you're talking about Jocelyn, getting him off the block, bang him a little bit when you have the ball, bang him a little bit when you're on offense. I think, you know, if Cleveland wants to go small, put Drummond in there and throw the ball to Drummond in the post. Let him whack him around a couple times. That'll slow him down a little bit. I think that's the kind of – it's almost like body punches in boxing, you know, slowing a guy down. I think you want to take your opportunities on the when he's playing defense to really bang him and make him work and then jostle him on the low block. Don't let him get comfortable down there.
Were you surprised by Stan's fine?
No, I was surprised it took as long as I was surprised it took until almost 9 o'clock the next night for it to be levied. But the minute I heard what he said, I was just, you know, kind of watching my email, waiting for Kiki Vandeweghe to pop in there with his look, it's one of those things where it's a standing rule. He knows the rule. He meant no intent. He's not trying to get the next call because he's complaining to a national television audience that can't relay the message to the officials anyway. It's not like you're better off just going and complaining to the official. But he was trying to get across the point that that's what he was telling his players, that you can't expect the call for LeBron. And he just said it the wrong way. It got him fined. I'm not surprised by it, but that's what happens when you put a live mic.
Why I was a little surprised that he got the fine, David, because I thought he was just saying, I'm telling my players, look, you're not going to get calls against LeBron. Be prepared for that. And I don't think that in and of itself is a criticism of the officials. The one line or the part that he said that I think got him the fine is when he said LeBron can do whatever he wants. That indicates or insinuates that the league is not going to officiate the games fairly because of the superstar treatment, and I think that's what burned him.
Yeah, well, he said, you can't get an offensive foul against LeBron. I asked him about a couple of specific plays on offensive fouls. Today there was a play in the second half. LeBron absolutely steamrolled Kentavious Caldwell-Pope in the open court. Pope may not have been there on time, but LeBron was completely out of control. I thought it was a clear offensive foul, and he wasn't about to comment on that today. So he just reiterated it's difficult to draw offensive fouls against LeBron.
Yeah, and you know, and he's right. You know, again, I think it's just a matter of how he says it. I think there is a way to say what he said. But I loved how he just owned it today, too, and said, I got a $25,000 fine for being myself. And that's really what he is. That's who Stan is. That's what he's always been. And how about, by the way, the little back and forth between Stan and LeBron James? You know, as LeBron was asked, you know, about his experiences with Stan, and he referenced the fact that Stan got the better of him back when he was the coach in Orlando, and LeBron has gotten him some, too. And there is some history here, you know, between these two guys. Although LeBron went on to say, I'm not playing against Stan or Stan Lee or any other Stan they can find. It's us and the Pistons. But there, you know, there is a little bit of history here between, you know, Stan and LeBron. And Stan kind of let LeBron know that, you know, and everybody else, obviously, that there is an uphill, it is an uphill fight, or if you will, as I mix my metaphors here, it's uphill for him to climb to beat LeBron when LeBron is going to get the benefit of the majority of the doubt.
Well, and, you know, Stan is, as you mentioned right off the top, he's trying to have a good time with this. He's not doing a very good job of it. Stan's perpetually miserable inside when he's coaching. He's miserable when he's coaching, and when he's not miserable, he's miserable that he's not miserable coaching. Okay, that's who Stan Van Gundy is at his essence. So this is the least miserable he can be right now, and so any of those interactions he can have with LeBron where, you know, he can have a good time with coaching basketball and being only semi-miserable is nirvana for Stan Van Gundy.
Would he describe it the same way?
Yes. Actually, he would. Yeah, he would.
Have you discussed that with him?
Yes. Yeah, we talked to him today a little bit about it, and he said, no, I'm not having a good time at all. So, and right, you know, even before the series, he said, I don't enjoy the adjustments at all. I just wish it was easy.
Well, you know what? If they can somehow steal one of those games in Cleveland that you talked about when you said maybe a Cavaliers in six type of series, get this one tonight, I bet he'll be a little bit less miserable tonight around 11 o'clock.
You bet, yeah.
All right. Hey, David, really great stuff. I appreciate you making the time to talk with us. I know you're a busy guy, and we really enjoy your writing. Keep up the great work, and hopefully we can talk to you again down the line.
You bet. Good being with you.
Thank you so much, David. David Mayo, who covers the Pistons, beat writer for the for MLive.com, and does just an outstanding job. So we've had both of the MLive beat writers covering the Pistons in the last 3 days. We talked to Aaron McCann on Monday, and we referenced a little bit of David's writing about the coaching matchup between Stan Van Gundy and Tyronn Lue, which, quite frankly, Tyronn Lue had won in game number one. All right, real quick before we take a break, I want to take some time on this Wednesday, the 20th day of April in the year of our Lord 2016, and say congratulations to the KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week for Wednesday. And guess who it is? It is the Quinlan siblings. Clay softball's Natalie Quinlan smacked a two-run walk-off double as Clay finished off an 11-1 win. A walk-off double? Over Notre Dame due to the mercy rule? I guess so. Yeah, because that punched it up over the mercy rule. That's what it was. Clay softball now 4-1, overall 2-0 in the track. And for the boys, Clay baseball's John Quinlan, of course. Oh, so they're not siblings. My apologies. I said siblings. They're cousins. They're cousins Quinlan. John is the cousin of Natalie. Anyway, John just minutes after his cousin had her walk-off double, had his own walk-off to beat St. John's back on Friday 4-3. How's that? That's kind of cool. That was a 4-3 game. The rally and the win keep Clay undefeated on the season at 8-0 overall and 2-0 in the track. So they are your KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week. And don't forget, if you've got a high school athlete that you think deserves to be recognized for their efforts and their achievement, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Please send your nomination. Tell us who they are. Tell us where they go to school and what they did. It was so awesome. And we'll recognize them on the radio. Send your nominations to athlete at 106.5theticket.com. Athlete at 106.5theticket.com. All right. Good stuff from David Mayo. Good stuff from Scott Petrak. Now let's get some good stuff from you. We'll take a timeout, get a bottom of the hour break and a sports center. And then I want to hear from you, 866-240-1065, especially on the football side of things. Do you agree with the Browns' decision to trade the number two overall pick, thereby possibly passing up on another franchise quarterback? I'll explain what I mean by another, and you probably already know, but I'll explain it again coming up after this timeout right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Answer right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, that's where we are. We're going to take you all the way up until 5 o'clock in drive time with Mr. Miller, which is about 21 minutes away. Certainly look forward to that. Get his take on what the Browns just did today. Get his take on game number two between the Pistons and the Cavaliers. We got a lot of that from Scott Petrak already on the Browns and David Mayo of MLive.com on the Pistons. And obviously it's going to be a very interesting night tonight. I want to go back because I was only able to gloss over this. Excuse me. 866-240-1065. Hold on. Again, battling this cough. It's just hard to deal with. Apologies. I talked to Scott Petrak about this almost just in passing in the first hour of the program, and because we had Scott on, he covers the Browns to give us some perspective on what the big trade was today and why they made it. And I mentioned this in passing, and I want to give a little more depth to it. On ESPN, just coincidentally, this was posted 4 hours ago on ESPN.com, our website. And we like to refer to this to as much as possible, refer to ESPN.com because we are ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, being an affiliate. We like to read it and get most of our news from there, and we certainly hope you do too. And 4 hours ago, Jeremy Fowler, an ESPN staff writer, wrote an article or posted an article, a pretty impressive one, by the way, entitled "The Day the Browns Passed on Big Ben." And the feature, of course, is the 2004 draft. 12 years ago, when the Browns had an opportunity after, Eli Manning and Phillip Rivers went in the top two in switching teams. Eli Manning was going to be drafted by the Chargers, as you know. He threatened, Archie Manning told him, don't do it. He's not going to sign. He's not going to come. He's going to sit out the year, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't want to go to San Diego for whatever reason. And so they drafted him, traded him to the Giants, then got, of course, Phillip Rivers in the deal, and the rest is history. Eli Manning's got two Super Bowl championships. But at any, and Phillip Rivers has been one of the best quarterbacks of his era. But Ben Roethlisberger was still sitting there when the Browns took their had their pick at number 6 overall. He was sitting right there. He was a tremendously talented prospect with a high ceiling, but many in the Browns, as you go on to read the article, many of the front office personnel with Cleveland felt like the competition in the MAC wasn't good enough to really measure him and to really think that he's worth the number 6 overall pick in the draft. And they're quoting some of the Browns organization at the time, including Coach Butch Davis, who was making all of the picks. He was the head coach and executive vice president from 2001 to 2004. And Butch Davis said, everybody recognized he was an enormous physical talent. There couldn't have been a worse day during his workout. It became apparent he could put on a show because it was cold and blustery and kind of drizzly and rainy, like every Sunday in that division, and he threw it extremely well. I like working out guys because you can see firsthand what they can really do. Well, it was a tremendous workout, and yet the Browns didn't see enough or hadn't seen enough to make him their pick. They were infatuated with the son of legendary Hall of Fame tight end Kellen Winslow from the Chargers. They were infatuated with his son, Kellen Winslow Jr., as you know by now, from Miami of Florida. They moved up a spot from 7 to 6 to get him. They actually gave away picks to move up one spot to make sure that nobody else stole Kellen Winslow from them. You know the drill by now. So anyway, Ben Roethlisberger has this great workout with them. He's got all of this potential. And the Browns make a decision that would ultimately for the next, and this was 2004, so far 12 years and counting, come back to bite them as they continue to search for the elusive franchise quarterback they've been unable to pin down and take or sign or whatever. It could have all been history. As I quoted from the article when I talked to Petrak, the article by Jeremy Fowler, the most decorated quarterback jersey in Cleveland, Ohio, contains 24 names. It starts at the top with Couch, and then it goes Detmer, Wynn, Peterson, Holcomb, and on down the line to about 19 more names. And as Jeremy writes, it could have stopped right there after Holcomb with Roethlisberger. He could be the Browns quarterback right now, today, still. The Browns could be and should be drafting a playmaking safety or a wide receiver for a playoff team instead of potentially looking at the franchise's 25th starting quarterback since 1999. How could they have passed on Ben Roethlisberger? And you might say, well, that's ancient history. You can't look in a rearview mirror and expect to see the future. Fair enough. Understood. But Ben Roethlisberger, the decision to pass on Roethlisberger, isn't something that Roethlisberger took lightly. It affects the future because it affects the now. Roethlisberger said, and I quote, when Cleveland passed on me, technically my hometown team, because he's from Findlay, as you know, went to Miami and Oxford. He said, technically my hometown team. That was it. I couldn't wait to have a team and play the Browns at some point. 22 starts later, Ben Roethlisberger has played the Browns like a fiddle. From hell. He's 20-2 against the Browns in his career and undefeated against them in Pittsburgh. Think about how their fortunes could have changed had the Browns pulled the trigger on Ben Roethlisberger back in 2004. Now, let's fast forward to today. Why are we bringing all this up again? Well, A, because it was on ESPN.com today, and it was the first time we saw the story. But B, because is history about to repeat itself? We won't know this until probably 5 years from now, obviously, because we look back now with 12 at Ben Roethlisberger and see the career that he's had, and we say, obviously, that was a huge mistake by the Browns not taking him. Look at who he is. Look at what he is. We can't say the same thing about Carson Wentz right now. And, of course, we are assuming that number one overall, the Los Angeles, that's going to take some getting used to, isn't it? The Los Angeles Rams are going to take Jared Goff from Cal, number one overall. If the Eagles, who have now taken this pick from the Browns in exchange for that bounty of draft picks, follow suit. They're going to take Carson Wentz. And essentially what's going to happen is this. We are all going to watch Carson Wentz every Sunday, or we're going to look in their box scores on ESPN or on our apps or whatever. We're going to look at the box score and see what Carson Wentz did in all of the next few years that he starts at quarterback for the Eagles. And it's what he does there that's going to determine whether or not that on the very same day ESPN reminded Browns fans everywhere of the day they passed on Ben Roethlisberger to get Kellen Winslow. On the very same day that that story ran, the Browns traded the opportunity to draft Carson Wentz, who could very well go on to be a multi-time Pro Bowler, and a playoff winning quarterback, and maybe even a championship winning quarterback. And they could be watching this whole thing play out again over the next 15, 16, 17, 18 years, the way they are right now with Ben Roethlisberger. Only time will tell. And oh, by the way, the comparisons don't stop there. The comparisons stop, well, don't stop, but they actually continue when you look at the small school story. Remember what Butch Davis said? He said, quite frankly, that the MAC wasn't a good enough conference. We don't have enough real film on him to see how he'll handle the biggest and baddest, the best of the best, in terms of pass rushers, in terms of coverage, gaps, windows, places to put the football are going to be a little bit smaller, all that stuff. You know, Ben Roethlisberger and the MAC just didn't show enough because of the quality of competition there to show whether or not he can play at this level. And now that's what Carson Wentz is dealing with, isn't he? Carson Wentz was called by John Gruden during Gruden's quarterback camp. He said he might be the most prepared guy to come out of the league, or out of the college, I should say, and into the league to play right now and be hugely successful that he's seen in years. That's what John Gruden said. But what's Carson Wentz suffering from? He's suffering from small school syndrome, just in the same way as Ben Roethlisberger was, that dropped him down to 11th in the draft when he was eventually taken by the Steelers. Carson Wentz is North Dakota. And when you are small school and there's big money and the number one or number two spots, well, obviously, you know, there are some questions. So it's just going to kind of be interesting to find out how Carson Wentz's, I almost said Palmer, Carson Wentz's career turns out. If he turns out to be a multi-time Pro Bowler, a guy that, you know, like Roethlisberger, is just, wow, what a great, great find, what a great pick, what a great decision, blah, blah, blah. And it comes back to bite them again for years and years to come. There will be no living that down. None. It'll be impossible for the Browns under new management, new ownership since that pick in 2012, by the way, new ownership, Jimmy Haslam, new general manager slash vice president, whatever you want to call the guy making the picks, and in this case it's going to be Sasha Brown. But all of that is new, and they're still going to have the same exact problem, making the same exact mistakes if they let Carson Wentz get away. Scott Petrak joined us earlier on. His view is this is a mistake. There are very few opportunities that teams have to draft or acquire a true franchise quarterback. As the 25-person or 25-name jersey shows, it's very difficult to do. When you have the second round or second pick in the draft, you have an opportunity to do it. You have the opportunity to take one and make him your future of your franchise. You don't pass it up. I think it's a mistake. Scott said it was a mistake. I think it's a mistake. I think you get that quarterback, and you go about filling the rest of the holes around him as you go. Make it a multi-year process, probably 2 to 3 to 4. Before you get all of those pieces and parts put together, just as, by the way, your quarterback should be coming into his own. What a unique concept. All right, so if you want to respond to that, and I see some people do, 866-240-1065, we'll get you up and on the radio as soon as I can. But before I take this time out and give you a traffic break, I also want to give you something fun. I've got another pair of tickets available to you right now. If you want to go see Jim Gaffigan live at the Toledo Zoo, if you're a stand-up comedy fan, you love Jim Gaffigan. I know I do. I'm a huge stand-up comedy fan. Gaffigan's going to be at the zoo on July 22, all right, July 22nd. If you'd like to go, we'll give you the tickets if you call caller 10 right now at 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065, right here on the Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Big congrats to Steve Elliott, right? Is that he said, Big Ben?
Yeah,
Steve
right.
Elliott
yep,
of,
yep.
of Sylvania?
Absolutely.
Steve Elliott of Sylvania was the 10th caller, and that means he won the pair of tickets to go see Jim Gaffigan live at the Toledo Zoo in July. I think I'll have one more pair of those left for tomorrow's program, and we'll make sure to get them away. All right, let's go to the phones. And Steve in Toledo, another Steve this time, wants to talk about this Browns decision. Do you agree with the decision to trade away the number two pick and possibly your most recent chance at a franchise quarterback after failing on Manziel, failing on Whedon, failing on Quinn, failing on so many other number one first-round draft picks? How do you feel about the trade?
You know, at first I liked the deal, but then I stepped back and really dissected it. And this is my conclusion that I came up with, that this is a wrong move, and here's why. All I've heard from my Browns fans, friends, that, oh, we need to build up our roster on both sides before we get a quarterback. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, you're basically saying you're going to be the Los Angeles Rams then, who have done that and now have been looking for a quarterback the last 2 or 3 years. Why, having talent almost on at every other position, and they're still hunting for their quarterback, and then they had to make a massive trade to move up to the first pick. And now if Jared Goff, the guy I think that's who they're going to get, is not the guy, now they've wasted all that talent they've gathered because they're going to have to find another young quarterback.
Wait a minute.
And
wait. Hold on. Maybe I misunderstood you. Maybe you misspoke. I don't know. You think they're going to get who to play quarterback?
Goff.
You think they're going to get Jared Goff?
From other reports I'm hearing, whether it's Goff or Wentz, I guess it really doesn't matter in this sense because
Wait. Hold on. Maybe I missed something here. Maybe I totally flaked, and I apologize if I did. Are you still talking about the Browns, or are you talking about the Rams and Eagles?
Well, I'm talking about the Rams and the Browns. And the Rams, I'm saying the Rams.
The Rams are going to get Goff, probably.
Right. I'm saying is the Cleveland Browns were going to be the Rams in the sense of they're requiring these picks, they're building up their roster, and then they won't be able to find a quarterback.
Right, okay.
And what's going to end up happening is, they're going to have to trade a lot of picks to get at some point to get a quarterback like the Rams.
I see what you're saying. So like the Rams got that huge haul from the Redskins, so the Redskins could get their quarterback, which was RG3, and they used them to build up, but they don't have any quarterbacks, so now they got to do the same thing that the Redskins did and send a bunch of picks so they can get theirs. So you're saying the Browns might be doing the same exact thing here.
Exactly.
I'm slow. I'm sorry. I wasn't quite following you, but I get it now. And that's very astute, by the way. If they use all of these 12 picks and a bunch of high rounders next year, too, just to build up and fill in all these other huge roster holes, and there are huge roster holes for this football team, if they do all of that, then how are they going to get their quarterback when's the opportunity going to present itself again? That's a great
point
to me.
And if they miss, so if the Rams miss, they have set back their team another decade because they have all this young talent they have right now. They're banking on the quarterback they're going to draft is going to take them to the promised land.
Yeah.
If they miss, they're going to be down a decade, and it's going to be the same thing with the Browns. The Browns are going to build up their roster. They're going to have to trade to get a young quarterback who they think is a savior, and if he doesn't turn out to be that way, they are going to set themselves back again.
Yeah, that's very well said. So, you know, essentially, you've got to do both things. You've got to fill in roster holes when you have just a crappy roster, and the Browns have probably the crappiest roster in the National Football League. You got to get your quarterback, and you got to fill those holes. What's the best order to do it in? I'm in agreement with you. If you are sitting at number two right now, then you take the quarterback. Get that part done and finished, then fill in the rest. By doing, you know, obviously drafting, there are still free agency opportunities. There are still other ways to find the pieces and parts you need. The hardest piece to acquire is always going to be that quarterback, and that's why it's probably the wrong order that they're doing this.
Yep.
Unless they just don't trust that Wentz is a franchise quarterback, and they figure, hey, we have just as much of a shot at Griffin finding his groove and becoming a franchise quarterback as we did with drafting Wentz, and therefore this is the right thing to do then. Maybe they feel like they already have that franchise guy.
You're absolutely right, but if Wentz becomes Ben Roethlisberger,
oh, and then they're going to, well, like I said to Scott, then ESPN's going to run another piece in 12, 13 years and say, the day the Browns passed on Wentz and traded their pick away. just like they did with this one. I got to run, Steve. Thanks for the call. Music is playing. I have completely flaked on the clock, too, man. My apologies. I got people on hold, and I'm sorry for keeping you there, but I got to end the show because music's playing. And when music's playing, I have to shut up. Miller's coming on next. He won't shut up. Maybe stick around and call him. Ground hold, stay there. Maybe he'll take your phone call coming up on Drive Time. Thanks for being a part of the show. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.